Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in our series, Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. In this edition, we're talking to three people living with diabetes who are sharing their experiences to help others. Professor Pete Alexander is a stress relief expert based near Seattle on the US West Coast, and he's been telling me about the techniques he's developed, which are summarized in a new book.
And then I ended up in the emergency room with a severe case of diabetic ketoacidosis. So, in effect, my body was eating itself alive because of my stress, and I was, according to the doctors, 1 hour from being comatose.
Megan Poynting from Southampton in the UK has trained two of her three pet spaniels to be diabetes alert dogs.
First of all, it was my oldest dog, Bobby, who used to act a bit strangely around me when I was having a hypo. He used to like sit on my lap and be really protective. So I obviously became aware that dogs can detect low blood sugar and high blood sugar.
Plus, we hear from Matthew Phillips in Manchester, who has a long family history of living with type 2 diabetes.
I wouldn't be a cocky, arrogant teenager. I'd listen to the doctors. I'd take advice. Because I wouldn't want anyone with an early diagnosis to be in the situation that I'm in.
I'm Claire Levy from DRWF, the host of our podcast, Living with Diabetes. Professor Pete Alexander has been diagnosed with stress-induced diabetes and has subsequently developed a range of techniques to help him cope better. Having studied the condition, he now practices as a stress relief expert. He's published a new book called Lighten Your Day, Fast, Easy and Effective Stress Relief. We started by discussing his own diagnosis.
It was initially diagnosed as type 2, and it was back in 2008. More recently, I was re-diagnosed as type 1, but NOLO version of that, so having characteristics of both type 1 and type 2.
Oh, okay. So how did this affect your work and personal life?
Well, initially, I mean, the diabetes actually was stress-induced. And I know that there's not a direct correlation between stress and getting diabetes. But for your listeners, they can understand that when you are stressed, immensely, it creates cellular inflammation in your body, and that cellular inflammation leads to chronic diseases like diabetes, cancer, heart disease. So in 2008, it was a perfect storm of stressful activities that were happening to me, including my dad dying, and I had to take care of his affairs. My mom had major hip surgery and needed care herself. I was running a very active small business. I had my children were really small and wanted my attention. And I had a marriage that was heading for a divorce. So there were a lot of things that I was juggling and a lot on my shoulders. The crazy thing is that I didn't listen to my body about what stress was doing to it. And instead, I continued to burn the candle at both ends. When I was diagnosed with diabetes, I didn't have this poor me moment. I just said, okay, just give me the medication. Let me do it. And the only time that I had an issue was when I moved from the pills to the injectable insulin pens, and no one told me how to use it. I had to look at the package insert, and here I was stabbing myself once a day. And that was when I thought, what has happened to me? But then I continued to move on, and I kept pushing, as I said earlier about burning the candle at both ends. And then I ended up in 2018 in the emergency room with a severe case of diabetic ketoacidosis. So in effect, my body was eating itself alive because of my stress. And I was, according to the doctors, 1 hour from being comatose. So the diabetes obviously continued to be a primary aspect of my life. And now that I had that experience, it was an epiphany moment for me, and I decided that I needed to take better care of myself, and I've done that, and have been helping others try and avoid getting diabetes like I had with that, this, you know, by stressing themselves out, and, you know, avoiding having any other issues like that diabetic ketoacidosis.
So did you get some better diabetes education to improve your self-management?
Yes, I've always been a member of the American Diabetes Association, but what really works better is just to understand what affects the blood sugars for you. And so I use a diabetes pump, and I also use a glucose monitor. And I can see with that glucose monitor what spikes me and what doesn't spike me. And, it's depending on regular foods that you eat normally, you obviously will understand and learn what it does to your body, and what exercise will do to your body. The challenge is when you're eating something that you normally wouldn't, and you estimate what your bolus should be with the insulin, and that's where it can be a little more problematic, especially if I start getting lower and I have to grab a glucose tablet or something like that to adjust myself.
Sure, it's an ongoing juggling act, isn't it?
It is, and it's a lifetime thing. So yeah. you have to realize that challenge is that it's on a daily basis, and you know, it could be on an hour-to-hour basis, depending on it. And, you know, for your listeners, if you don't, you know, listen to your body. That's the key. I mean, when I got admitted into the ER with the ketoacidosis, my blood sugars were so high that those medical-grade glucose meters could not read my numbers. And so the highest, the medical grade ones go up to 800. So I was over 800 when I was admitted.
Following that, you made some big changes and have been experimenting with different tips and techniques to help you reduce your stress and keep healthy. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So it was the epiphany moment that I mentioned earlier. Here's the crazy thing. So burning the candle at both ends, you know, there I am in the emergency room. And then for my very first time in my life, I end up in the ICU for 3 days. I've been in the emergency room for sports injuries or my children getting hurt or something. But the ICU was a brand new experience. And on my second day, my boss at the time actually knew that I was in the ER and I was in ICU. And I remember on a Tuesday morning, I get this text and it says, you have a webinar you need to run at 8 o'clock in the morning. What are you going to do about it? And immediately I grab my phone and I try and do whatever I can to reschedule that. And the doctors and the nurses, they were continuously coming in and the nurses were checking my glucose every half hour. And so they checked it as I was doing this, and it was a 90-degree angle that my glucose numbers were going way, way, way up again. And so the nurse says to me, you realize that's what put you in this hospital bed in the first place. And there was that true epiphany moment. And so I decided after I got out of the ICU that I was going to do things differently. And so I decided, you know, luckily I was financially, I had done well with my money. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to focus on myself. And I started experimenting with various stress relief tools and techniques. And what I noticed was not only was my stress going down because of it, my glucose numbers went way, way down, my weight went down, and my energy went way, way up. It was as if I had discovered the Fountain of Youth, and it was a wonderful experience. And many of my peers had said, you know, what you've done, I'd love to get an opportunity to do that myself. And so I started collecting more and more different techniques that I was using, some that worked really well, some that worked okay, some that didn't work for me. And everybody said I should write a book, and that's what I did. And it's been very successful helping people. So I'm grateful for that.
Do you want to talk a bit about your career to date? Because that's quite interesting, I think.
Sure. So I started off after graduating college, I started off in sales and transitioned from sales into marketing when I actually was making a sales call on a doctor's office. And the doctor actually took me aside and said that he was the primary owner of a med device company and needed somebody like myself. And so I went into the medical device industry and spent many, many years in that industry. At the same time, I started getting into, back in the, you know, I'm dating myself now, mid-90s, this funny thing called the internet, and started doing internet marketing consulting, and actually started teaching classes on internet marketing and marketing strategy at the local universities. And I decided I wanted to get a PhD so that I could do that and be a true professor as opposed to just a lecturer. And so I taught for 12 years as well, and continued to stay in the medical device industry because that's lucrative, and it's a great area to be working on products that help people. And up until 2018, when I had that diabetic ketoacidosis, I was working in that industry, and then transitioned into the stress relief work after that.
So your book, Lighten Your Day: Fast and Easy and Effective Stress Release for When Happens, 100 plus tips and tools for people to try for themselves. Can you give us a brief rundown of how people can use the book?
Yeah, so the way that when I started doing the research for the book, I wanted to find out what areas of life are people being stressed out about. And so I found that there were 7 areas. And those 7 areas included your career, or I call it your livelihood, L, what I call your imagination or your conscious mind, which makes up 5% of your active brain. Then you have the G, which is genius. And that is your unconscious mind, where basically real change happens. It's what runs your body 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Then it's your physical health. So H is for health. T is for time. E is for your environment. And N is your network of relationships, the people you work with, the people you are, your family, your friends, etc. Those all make up the LIGHTEN, LIGHTEN, model for long-term stress relief. And so in the book, what I do is I organize the stress relief tips based on the different areas of your life. And the intent of the book, most stress relief books, if you look at them, or, you know, they focus on one or maybe two types of tips. So let's say you'll see a 300-page book on meditation or deep breathing or yoga. And the reality is, most people who are stressed out have very little time to spend working on a 300-page book just for one particular tip. And so the book, 96% of the tips can be implemented in 5 minutes or less. So what happens is, you're going into a meeting or a conference call, whatever, or a conversation you need to have, a difficult one, and you're worried, you're stressed, you've got anxiety, and you need to try something to calm yourself down. This is the perfect book for that. You pick it up, you take a look, you flip through it, grab one technique, you try it. If it works, you continue using it and long term, if you continue using it, you will benefit. If it doesn't work, you only spent a couple of minutes trying it. Next time, try a different tip and see if that works. And that's it's sort of like if you imagine going to a restaurant and looking at what you want to try. That's exactly how it would be with this book. The difference is you find one or two particular techniques that work for you and you implement them regularly. The long term benefits that you will get from that are absolutely outstanding.
And we'll hear more from Professor Alexander later in the podcast.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes from DRWF. Megan Poynting is a young woman expecting her first child. She's living with type 1 diabetes and is a firm dog lover and professional dog walker. She wanted to see if it was possible to train her dogs to recognise the scent of problematic blood glucose levels so they could alert her in advance of developing symptoms. She told me more about her dogs, how she trained them, and her own diabetes.
So Bobby, our eldest dog, he is a Springer Spaniel. Bindi, our middle dog, is a Labrador Cross Springer Spaniel, and Obi is a working cocker. So they're all spaniels.
Yeah. And how long have you been living with type 1 diabetes?
So it'll be 2 years this June. So I was diagnosed in June of 2018. So yeah, nearly 2 years.
How old were you then? 23?
I was 23, yeah. So I was a bit on the older side compared to a lot of people I know who were diagnosed in childhood. But diabetes is actually really strong in my family. So both of my maternal grandparents had type 1 diabetes. My mum has type 1 diabetes, and my cousins on my mum's side have type 1 diabetes as well.
So what was it like in the early days, and did having that family link help you?
It sort of, but I kind of knew I wasn't ignorant to what it actually meant, what a diagnosis of diabetes actually meant. It was like I knew the bad side of it all straight away. And it was quite hard. I was in denial for a little while. I kept telling my doctors that I thought they'd got the diagnosis wrong, because I wasn't very sick at the start. I was quite well. I just went to the doctors on the off chance because I felt a bit sort of under the weather, and I thought I might have like some kind of infection. And then all of a sudden my sugars were like 30 and they were rushing me off to the hospital. But in myself, I felt absolutely fine. So I just thought they got it wrong to start with. And it was like, it's quite complicated because of my age, they sort of diagnosed me with bladder. And it was like, oh, it might be type 2 or it might be type 1. And it took a good sort of 4 or 5 months before I got a solid type 1 diagnosis. So it was quite difficult.
So when did you start to experience hypo and awareness, and what was that like?
So actually with hypo and awareness, I didn't have any awareness of my hypos from day one. I had no idea that I was having a hypo when I was having one, which is actually really scary because I have a really active job being a dog walker. So I would sometimes, my sugars would drop to like 3 and I would have no idea. And I'd be like out on a walk in the middle of nowhere, sort of in a field quite far away from my car. And I'd, you know, check my sugars and they'd be at 3 and I was like, oh, okay. You know, it always took me by surprise. And obviously it was quite scary in a sense that if like something were to go wrong and my hypo was to be quite a serious one, I was quite away from help. So that was obviously quite scary. So luckily I was given a Freestyle Libre fairly early on, which really helped because it was so much easier to just scan and see my sugars were going lower and dropping and be able to treat it before the hypo kind of got into full swing and was quite serious. So
following that on a Libre is really useful, isn't it? So you can see a trend.
So you get the arrows that say, you know, you're dropping fast, you're dropping a bit slower. So it was definitely really, really helpful to have. As soon as I got that, it really changed things for me.
So did you realize Obi was detecting, and how did you go on to train him, or was it something you said you worked with your other dog? So can you explain that process?
Yeah, of course. So First of all, it was my oldest dog, Bobby, who used to act a bit strangely around me when I was having a hypo. He used to like sit on my lap and be really protective and almost like, it was kind of unhelpful at times because he'd sit on me while I'm trying to get up and get hypo treatments. So I obviously became aware that dogs can detect low blood sugar and high blood sugar. So I, being a dog lover and, you know, having aspirations to work in dog training, I sort of thought to myself, this seems like a really good opportunity to turn this negative part of my life, like being type 1 diabetic, into something positive and link it with something that I adore, which is my dogs. So I took it upon myself to start training Bindi, who's our middle dog, just to add to confusion, just to practice and see if it was actually possible to do it myself. So I did tons of research and I started taking scent samples and I successfully trained Bindi to start alerting to low blood sugar. So I was really, really pleased with that. But I thought, I actually want a dog that I can train as a full assistance dog who can come out in public with me to places that dogs perhaps aren't normally allowed to go, as an added layer of protection for me when I'm out and about, to be able to have a dog there that can alert to my low blood sugar, which is why we decided to get Obi as a puppy, because my other two dogs are a bit older, so they're not really ideal to train to go out in public and do public access. So we got Obi as a puppy to train from a really young age to be able to be a full assistance dog, to go out in a jacket and be able to actually like alert out in public to low blood sugar.
And what's his alert? Does he sit or does he lick?
So he's still learning. He's nearly a year, so he's been learning for a little while, but it's a bit of a long process. But his alert and Bindi's both alert is pouring. So if my blood sugar goes low, they will come up to me and start pouring at me. I'm also teaching Obi simultaneously to get help if I am low. So he will alert to me, and then if I'm not quick enough on the uptake to sort it out myself, he will then go and alert to my husband or to someone else, which is like a really handy thing to be able to teach him, because he obviously, like, if your kind of your mental capacity may go down a bit when you have hypo, so to have someone there who can help you as well is obviously really helpful.
Brilliant. Yeah. So what sort of difference has this made to your life?
Oh, it made a huge difference. I mean, first of all, it was giving me such a positive focus around my diabetes, because it's quite a long process training a dog to alert to high or low blood sugar. You have to, you know, you have to take your scent samples and you have to, you know, go through a long training process. So it was definitely giving me a really positive focus. And it's also given me a lot more confidence, like, in terms of when I have a low blood sugar. I know I obviously have my Libre and all this stuff, but I also have the added layer of protection of my dogs, who can often pick up the hypo even before the Libre or the blood machines can pick them up. So they can detect the changes in your scent that are so subtle that they can often do it before even technology picks it up, which is just like so much better when, you know, like I say, I do an active job, and it just gives you that extra added layer of safety as well. And I think, again, with the confidence, like doing things like podcasts is something I would never have even considered doing before I got Obi, or like before I started doing the training with the dogs, because I just never talked about my diabetes. It just never was part, it was never something that I was ever spoke about. But having the dogs and doing all this training, you know, is really given me the confidence to get out there and talk to people in the diabetic community, and to kind of, you know, to just be part of it, and to just be, you know, I can't think of the right word, but
just to share
my story. They're basically, yeah, just share my story, and just to be, you know, more confident in the diagnosis that I was given, sort of thing.
And you're expecting a baby now. How has this affected your diabetes?
Yes. My sugars are a lot more volatile, I think would be the word. They can go from a really big high to a very quick low, and it happens very fast. So I'm keeping everyone on their toes, especially the dogs. But it has been helpful in terms of their training, because they've got a lot more to pick up on. And often my sugars, before I was pregnant, were quite steady, so I wouldn't have many hypos. But now I'm having more hypos. It's almost giving the dogs more of a chance to practice their alerts. So Every cloud has a silver lining, I suppose.
Is Obi adjusting to the changes?
He is, yes. Although at the moment he's sort of the baby in our house, so I'm not sure how he'll feel about when an actual baby comes along. He's a really loving dog, bless him. So he definitely knows something's up. He keeps kind of coming over to me and sort of sitting on me and looking at my tummy, and he's a bit like, something's going on here, I think.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So plans for the future?
Oh gosh, other than having a baby. More awareness, I think. I think a lot of people feel that having a diabetic alert dog is quite difficult and, you know, almost like an elite thing that is unattainable. But I want people to know that actually you can do it yourself, and it is possible to teach your own dog to alert to low blood sugar or high blood sugar, and to be able to do it yourself. Even if, like, some dogs, for example, our Bindi, would never go on to be a full assistance dog because she just doesn't have the ability to be out in public and not charging up to people saying hello and everything, but she can alert to low blood sugar. And even, you know, she might alert to me that one time at home, and it could very well save my life. And I think that's so important, that if you want to teach your dog to do that, that you should have the resources to be able to do that. And so I think for the future I'd love to make these resources more available to people, and to be able to, you know, go around and tell people you can do this too if it's something you want to do with your dog.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
When there's a long family history of diabetes, there's a high probability of also developing the condition. Matthew Phillips, who is now 45, was diagnosed with type 2 when he was 19. He told me he's married with two children and two dogs, but although he works in property management, he's spending an increasing amount of time promoting diabetes awareness, and recently recorded his own podcast to share his experiences. I started by asking about his family history.
Well, both my parents are diabetic. All four of my grandparents were diabetic, all type 2s. So I knew that it was, you know, it was because of poor lifestyle choice, a bit of genetics, but I didn't really have a full understanding of it because I wasn't told. I was just told, we've done some blood tests, you've been a bit thirsty, and you're diabetic.
And was that it?
And that was sort of the end of it. Yeah, that was it. That was all I was told.
Were you offered any education?
No. Nothing at all. I was just told, try and cut out the chocolate and take these tablets. And that was sort of the extent of the meeting with the doctor about it.
How did that make you feel?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really take it seriously. I just thought, well, you've got diabetes. It's obviously not overly serious. So if I keep an eye on my diet, I'll be all right.
Hmm.
Because, well, you know, when you are 19, you're completely invincible. You know best. And, well, you don't, really.
So did you make any lifestyle changes in the early years?
If I'm being honest, no. I just decided to carry on with the same sort of things that I was doing. I knew what I should and shouldn't be eating, but, you know, again, when you're 19, 20, you want to live your life. You know, you don't want to be told what to do. You don't want doctors preaching at you. You don't want your parents driving you mad. So you just carry on with things as they are.
Did you talk about it with anyone, with your friends or?
I remember talking about it with my parents, and because they'd been diabetic probably about 10 years at that point. And they had theirs fairly under control. And I remember having the conversation and they said, you know, you don't want it to get any worse. You need to sort of catch it now, nip it in the bud. But that was sort of it. I sort of listened to it a little bit. I think the majority of it probably went in one ear and out the other at that age.
What about friends?
I had one friend who was a type 1 diabetic at the time, and he was diagnosed when he was fairly young. But I knew that type 1 was a little bit different to type 2, so I thought, well, there's no point me saying anything to him because his is different to mine. And again, that was sort of, that was all the education I had about it.
Mm. So as you got older, how did your type 2 diabetes start to affect your life?
Well, it was only when I got to maybe, let me think, probably mid-30s, and I started getting pains and my eyesight started to change. And I never realised at that point that it was the diabetes that was affecting me. I just thought, well, you know, I'm getting older, these things happen. But yeah, I realised that things were happening, but I wasn't sure exactly what was going on. But I still carried on with my life as it was. I didn't make any changes even up to that point.
So you weren't monitoring your diet or exercising particularly?
No.
No.
No. You know, I hold my hands up. I was very negligent.
Mm. So what complications have you experienced in recent years? How does this affect your life?
Well, now I seem to suffer from every complication associated with diabetes. The worst being the nerve damage that comes with it, which unfortunately is irreversible. So that started maybe 10 years ago with pains in my legs. It then developed to pain in my hands, my feet, my arms. That again developed further into giving me an increased heart rate, giving me stomach problems, bladder problems, the fact that I don't heal at all. So if I get a cut or a knock, it takes months to heal. Even the simplest of paper cuts can take 2 to 3 months to heal. If you saw my hands now, you'd see that they're covered in tiny scars where I've caught my hands or I've done something, and it's taken months and months to heal. And I think between that and the nerve damage, it's just horrendous.
Mm. So how has your understanding of type 2 and the reasons the complications grown then?
Well, I think in the past maybe 5-6 years, when I've got the chance to see a very, very good diabetic specialist, I understand now more about type 2 diabetes than I ever have done in the past. You know, I really understand the ins and outs of it. I understand the complications because I've now gone into it in much more detail. So from what I've been told and for what I've researched myself, I seem to, you know, becoming a bit of an expert in type 2 diabetes now. And I can, you know, I understand the reasons for the complications. I now know how one thing affects something else, which then can have a knock-on effect to another complication.
And certainly we talk in the charity about good self-management, and it is those skills, isn't it, about understanding and managing your own diabetes in your own way that is so important.
Definitely. I think that it's very, very important. I think the education has to be there. So when somebody is given a diagnosis, they have to know how to deal with it, because it's not something that's like, for example, I've got a headache, well, take a tablet, or I've got a pain in my arm, rub some cream on it. With diabetes, it's something that if it's not controlled, it will cause major problems. You know, and it's severe. It's a chronic illness. All right, there are cases where people have reversed type 2 diabetes, but it's not, you know, it's not a common thing. People have to be taught and taught well how to manage it.
And one of the things we've been looking at on our podcast Pro is about a blended way of learning. And I think that's probably quite a good thing to look at for somebody like yourself who was diagnosed at quite a young age with type 2, that it's not always a one size fits all, that there are, as you know yourself, all sorts of different ways of learning. And I think you've got to sort of maybe manoeuvre your way through You don't necessarily want to be sitting in a classroom, do you?
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it is a minefield. And I think when people are diagnosed at a young age, so you're talking sort of late teens, they don't want to be preached to by a doctor or any health professional, because they will think what I did and they'll think they're invincible. So I think that now with sort of the, we're in the social media world. So I think things have to be done to engage younger people and make them listen, because they're just not going to listen to doctors. They don't want to hear experts. They want to see, I don't know, they want to see a celebrity they may know who's diabetic tell them something, because then they'll listen to it. They want to listen to somebody who has experienced this rather than your stereotypical doctor looking over a pair of glasses at them saying to them, well, don't eat this and don't eat that. So I do agree with what you say. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. It's just finding the right solution and the right method to communicate it.
If you could turn back the clock, what if anything, would you do differently?
Oh, everything. I'd listen to the doctors. I'd take advice. I would have researched it more myself, because I wouldn't want anyone with an early diagnosis to be in the situation that I'm in. Mm. So, yeah, I would be less negligent. I wouldn't be a cocky, arrogant teenager, because you get told when I was diagnosed that, you know, you may have eyesight problems when you're 80 years old, and you think, well, I'm 60 years off that. But you don't realise how fast time goes and how quickly things can change. So, you know, if hindsight's a wonderful thing, but yeah, if I could go back, all I'd say, I'd highlight the fact that you've just got to listen. You've got to be sensible and listen to the advice that you're given.
Mm. You started your own podcast. What's it called and what inspired you?
Yeah, well, I thought I would try and engage with some of the younger people. And I think the way to do it is through things like podcasts, YouTube, all the social platforms. So I set something up called Still Thirsty, which is my podcast, and it's available to download on Podbean. And all it is, it's just very simply my experiences with diabetes. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through what type 2 diabetes is, what the complications are, and how you can look after yourself. But I'm just going to do it from, and although I'm probably classified as not young anymore, I'm going to do it as from a younger person's point of view, and someone who's actually not taken the advice in the past and who is currently suffering with the majority of the complications, you know, in the hope that even if one person listens to it and thinks, you know something, I don't want to end up with the things that he's going through, then it's made a difference.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes from DRWF. And our thanks to Matt Phillips for sharing his story. So to finish, let's return to Professor Pete Alexander. I asked him for an example of one of his stress relief techniques.
Yeah, so, you know, especially with this, the current crisis that we have, one of the ones that I like to recommend to my clients is what I call don't try and control the uncontrollable. And what that means is, you know, when we're faced with a stressful situation, our human nature is to stress about all aspects of that situation, both what we can control and what we can't control. The problem with that is that it splits up all of our mental capabilities into all these different things, and we tend to feel like we're getting out of control, and that causes additional stress. So the technique is to create two lists. One list of this, whatever the stressful situation is, one list is what you can control. The other list is what you can't control. So if we look at the COVID-19 situation, we have no control about what the government will do. We have no control about what other people will do, whether or not they're wearing masks or not. You have no control over anyone else other than yourself. So you list out all of those things that you can't control. Then on the other list, you list what you can control. Can you wear a mask? Can you make sure you wash your hands frequently? Can you keep yourself healthy by eating right? Those kind of things are things that are under your control. And then once you have those two lists, you focus as much of 100% of your mind share on that list that you can control. And then what happens is when you feel like you can control the aspects of the situation and affect change in it, your stress goes way, way down versus the things you can't control, you can't affect change. It doesn't serve you at all to worry about those. So focus on what you can control and you will notice that things will change and your stress will go down.
You're absolutely right. Controlling what you can control is the most important. And being happy in your space.
Happy in your space. That's the environment aspect as well. Because if you have things in your environment that are not supporting your stress relief efforts, it's just going to add stress. A classic example of that is if your desk is a complete mess and you waste time trying to find certain things because it disappears in the piles of stuff. Well, maybe it's time to organize the desk.
I did that during lockdown.
Yeah, it works. I mean, there's a lot of things that people can be doing while they're at stay at home that can really benefit them. And if they use the time wisely, if they sit in the victim role, the challenge that you have is that you just tend to continue to wallow in that negativity. And one of the things I always like to use for someone who is in, like, I like to call it the poor me mode, is I say to them, ask yourself this one question and truly, truly answer it honestly. Is there anyone else in the world having it worse than me right now?
So what's your health like today? Is your mental and physical health in balance? And most importantly, how is your diabetes?
Yeah, so my mental and physical health is definitely in balance. It got tested, perfect example, it got tested a few months ago. I was right before the whole COVID outburst happened. I was working in the garage up about, let's say, 4 meters up in the air, and the ladder slipped from underneath me. And so I went tumbling down onto the concrete of the garage, and I severely damaged my shoulder, basically broke it up, broke bones, dislocated it, nerve damage, etc. And certainly I was stressed when I drove myself to the emergency room. And I have continuous issues with that as I recover and I have to do the physical therapy, but it was a real good test for me to see how I would deal with some major adversity. And what I've done to work on my mental and physical health really has helped me, because I continue to maintain my health. I go for walks. I'm very grateful that I could have been paralyzed or killed in that accident if I would have fallen slightly differently. And, my mental health is very, very good, too. I'm a very balanced person, and that's reflective in my diabetes numbers. As I said earlier, I have the glucometer that tells me, where I'm going. And, I rarely have huge spikes. And when I do, I do some mindfulness, some techniques that I like to use to be able to calm myself down, and I see it, immediate benefits in my numbers.
And do you work with other people living with diabetes?
I do. I have coached some people who have, and a lot of them, it's interesting, they have the attitude that, oh my gosh, why did this happen to me? And so what I do is I work with them to get over the victim mode. You know, the fact of the matter is it's happened. Now let's try and work around it so that this does not become a problem long-term for you. And, you know, and the fear is such a powerful emotion. And if you worry about, oh my gosh, I've got diabetes, my life is over, I'm going, you know, it's going to be just all downhill from there. Well, what happens is that our mind has such a strong influence on our body that if you truly believe that, that you are going to have a self-fulfilling prophecy, and you will end up getting yourself sicker and sicker instead of saying, okay, this happened to me. Let me get whatever medication and other advice I'm getting from healthcare professionals. And what can I do to overcome the problems with this and still lead a healthy mental and physical life? And that's what I've done with the diabetes clients that I've worked with is I don't let that be a hindrance for them. I let them say, okay, here's, you know, this is a new challenge. And you know, many of the people that I've worked with have had diabetes for years, so they know how to deal with it. But what they maybe don't know how to deal with is the glucose spikes that happen when they're stressed. And that's where I can come in and help them mediate that a bit.
Brilliant. And anything else you'd like to add?
Sure. For any of your listeners who, you know, in this current stage, what we're dealing with worldwide, if they find themselves overly stressed, what I encourage them to do is go to my website at Pete Alexander, PeteAlexander.com/blog, BLOG. Every tip that I have in the book, each week I take one and I publish a written as well as a video on that tip. And they can go in there, they can subscribe just with their email. I don't spam anyone. And they can get a new stress relief tip that they can give a try. It doesn't take very long. And get, you know, and that can help help them get through this or any other particular situation that they might be faced with coming up in the future.
Professor Alexander's book, Lighten Your Day, Fast, Easy and Effective Stress Relief, is available in paperback, on the Kindle, and also as an audiobook. And that brings us to the end of this edition of DRWF's podcast, Living with Diabetes. To keep up to date with the latest news and information, or to discover how you can continue to support DRWF at this challenging time, please visit the website at drwf.org.uk. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to all the people who talked to us and also to you for listening. I'm looking forward to joining you again in our next edition of Living with Diabetes.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora Media production for DRWF. Copyright 2020, Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.